Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up with a grant from the Scarman Trust in 2002 and goes out every Thursday morning at 11 a.m. here on BCFM 93.2. This week, Machiavellian warmongers, secretive societies behind the scenes. We talk to American academic and historian and author Webster Tarpley. And we also have a look at some of the more modern wars, that is, particularly focusing on the Israel-Palestine conflict. We start this week with Elia Pablo and the Tech Roundup. Hi, Elia. Welcome to Dialect.
Hello, thank you.
Now, first of all, we talked last week about Facebook's manipulation of their news feed. 7,000 users. This is to discover if there's a link between its content and the user's mood. The researchers that conducted the experiment, they have to apologise after the widespread negative response. But it's not the first time Facebook manipulated its users in order to gather more information about themselves. In particularly, they were looking at putting positive stories on the news, and then the users would feel nice. They then put negative stories on the news to make them feel bad. Now, this is quite nasty manipulation of Facebook. What do you think that they're up to manipulating in any other ways or just this way?
Yeah, it's not the first experiment they conduct. Apparently, they did another one about security issues. So some users were threatened by losing their accounts if they didn't verify their identity. Facebook sent them a message saying, oh, we think you're not using your real name. You have to verify your identification. If not, we will shut your account.
Hang on a second, because why should you use your real name? Surely you can just be an alias if you want to on Facebook. Why do you have to use the right spelling of it and all that kind of thing?
Exactly. That's exactly what I asked myself. But apparently, actually, my personal example, I tried to change my name a few months ago and they didn't allow me because they said that wasn't my real name, which was quite late. It was true, but is there in my contract I have to use my real name?
No, I don't think it is it?
But apparently in this experiment, what they wanted to do is to check the anti-fraud system. They wanted to make it more secure because, actually, to be fair, imagine that Facebook or your bank send you an email, a message saying, oh, you have to verify this because there is a problem. And you go there and the hacker can have access to all the information about yourself. So it was actually kind of useful.
Okay, so what was the purpose of that from Facebook's point of view?
From Facebook's point of view was exactly that, security issues.
But it wasn't really, was it? In a way, what they're doing is they're trying to force people to use all their real information. I mean, for example, you could put a false date of birth. Are Facebook going to close your account if you put a false date of birth?
No one actually lost their account, and actually people that they pick did use their real names. But yeah, maybe at some point they will decide that you have to use your real place of birth or your real date of birth, and they can close it.
Okay. I mean, you can see, obviously, that one of the main reasons that they might want to do this is to stop trolls.
Yeah.
Trolling around, pretending to be someone and just being annoying. But then again, surely everybody, if they're going onto Facebook, has a right to make up a personality if they want to. They don't have to use their proper name. In fact, they might have legitimate reasons for not wanting to use their proper name. Say, for example, if they think they might lose their job.
Yes, exactly. But on the other hand, I would say I'm Facebook. I'm the super platform. You choose to use me, so you have to follow my rules.
Oh, no. Yes, they are too powerful.
Exactly.
Well, we've all accepted a contract with Facebook, terms and conditions, but the platform itself, Facebook, keeps changing its terms. Why are these changes? Is Facebook changing its premises as well?
It's all the time changing the terms of conditions. It's actually a complaint from 2005. They've been changing it all the time, doing it more complex and adding more things. And for example, why it happened lots of times is that all your information, let's say your picture, profile picture, your normal pictures, your date of birth, these things that you made it private when you set it up, they just public and you didn't see. They didn't tell you. So that's the main complaint. They basically keep changing these things. They changing your privacy to public, and they don't inform.
They're abusing their power, exactly. Aren't they? I mean, if you make an agreement with them, it's a bit like, well, say, with a bank or any kind of contract. Really, it's got to be both people that decide they want to change. But what Facebook are saying in a rather sneaky way is either you agree to this. They're pointing a gun to the head of their users, aren't they? They're saying either you do this or you leave.
You can always leave, but the question is why you or me haven't left. We know all this and we are still on Facebook.
Well, that's true. I mean, I do use it a lot for sharing information, and it's also nice to stay in touch with your friends. But the thing is, I used to use web forums more. To post on web forums, they stay there on the internet permanently. Facebook is constantly dying. You know, the information from Facebook is constantly sinking away into nothingness.
Yeah, but it's always there.
They have it,
and they can use it against you. And the thing is, like, it used to be for you. Like, I used to feel it like it was a service for the users to share their information, to keep in touch with their friends. And now it's more and more about the agencies, the publicity and these kind of things.
Okay, well, the US Federal Trade Commission sued Facebook back in November 2011, alleging that it deceived its users by telling them their information was private and then sharing it with third parties. So what was the result of that? Because last January, two particulars sued Facebook again for similar reasons.
Yeah, it's all privacy issues. So the Federal Trade Commission did it because they said, it's what we were saying just now, it deceived its customers because it changed what the users put as private as public, and they didn't let them know. So for months, like, I remember actually that in my newsfeed I had lots of friends putting the same message, like saying, oh, there is this, like, check your profile because you will see now it's public, and put it back into private. So that's why they were sued, and the result was that they have to go under an internal audit to check their privacy, together with Google and Twitter. But it seems that nothing has really changed, because again, these two private guys that just sued Facebook was because they said that Facebook reads all your private comments, so in the internal chat, looking for keywords to sell to the advertisement companies. Mm.
God, well, it's, you know, really annoying that they do that, because you should at least have a choice as to whether they can do that or not. But you're
exactly.
not given any choice. Really, I mean, I think, you know, you can see it from Facebook's point of view. They're saying, well, we're providing this service for free, so you should just be lucky if you think you can use it.
Yeah, that's, I mean, we all know the publicity is the thing that makes Facebook worth. So all their value
we're is giving we're giving
the
them more publicity today, aren't we?
Yeah. But yeah, that's like we're giving them all. Do you remember what we talked the other day about Facebook actually giving us the option to change our profile and saying, oh, I like more technology advertisement, I like more cars or things like this. So it's all about advertisement nowadays.
It is, isn't it? And selling us and our preferences
yes.
to commercial companies. Continuing with privacy concerns, lots of employers say they check Facebook's profiles of potential employees to decide whether to recruit them or not. Also, information found in profiles of current employees as a result of them losing their jobs sometimes. Is that actually legal or is it just discrimination?
Well, some say it's what you do in your free time, so that wouldn't have to be a cause of you don't getting a job or not or losing a job. But on the other hand, like, I would say if it's because you are homosexual, for example, that's definitely a discrimination. So if your boss don't get you the job because you are homosexual or...
But how do they know? How do you know when they're discriminating? This is a trouble.
That's the problem. Because if it's because, let's say, they saw pictures of you partying, that's your real life. Like, that's your free time. What I would say is, if your free time doesn't affect your job, then that's discrimination.
There's some news just out this week from the Los Angeles Times as well. I'm sorry, it's always bad news, it seems, when it comes to Facebook. But Facebook is going to be tracking users' television habits. Facebook Nielsen partnership is part of a stepped up campaign to get a better glimpse of how people are using computers and mobile devices for their own entertainment. This is on the Los Angeles Times website. They say beginning this autumn, when Facebook users watch a TV show on a cell phone or a tablet, Facebook will probably know about it. The social network will scan its databases and send the age and gender of the viewer to Nielsen, the TV ratings measurement company. So what's happening, of course, is that the app that you're using on your mobile device is not just doing Facebook, it's also monitoring all sorts of other activity that's going on your tablet and on your smartphone.
And it's just filing a profile about you that they will sell to a third party.
Okay, there's also some big shocking, I suppose shocking, but it almost becomes a bit less shocking every time you hear another shocking thing from the Edward Snowden releases this week. We hear that from the wonderful Glenn Greenwald, who's been the journalist over based in Brazil, who's been looking through so many of these Snowden leaks to find out what he will not get sued for, I suppose, publishing, and what he won't really compromise national security, because a lot of it could. So his job, Glenn Greenwald, really is to go through and say, well, if I publish this, it might mean that national security would be really compromised, and he has to weed through it. But anyway, this week he's saying in The Guardian, at least that's what they're reporting this week, that documents leaked by Edward Snowden reveal programs to track targets, spread disinformation and manipulate online debates, even going as far as actually changing polls online, so that if you're doing an online poll, that there will be little robots set up by GCHQ and paid for with our money, government money, in order to change the result of those polls. There's several different programs revealed in this document, and it's first of all Gateway, which gives the ability to artificially increase traffic to a website, so it makes a website appear to be very, very popular, even though actually there's hardly anyone looking at it, for example. And Clean Sweep, what it does is it masquerades Facebook wall posts for individuals or entire countries. So what it's doing is just saying, making out that people have been posting lots and lots of things online when actually nothing's been happening at all. And Scrap Heap Challenge, they call it, for perfect spoofing of emails from BlackBerries. So if you've got a BlackBerry, GCHQ can make it look as if you're sending all sorts of emails to people. I suppose that's just basically hacking an account, effectively make it look like you when it isn't you. Underpass, which is changing the outcome of online polls, and Spring Bishop, they call the final one, to find private photos of targets on Facebook. I know another one of the things that they were saying as part of this article, part of this leak, was that they can artificially boost the number of views on YouTube videos to make it look as if a YouTube film which has only been viewed by 5 people, it says something like 100,000 people have looked at it. So there's a lot of stuff going on. What are your thoughts ultimately about whether anything's going to be done about this? Because this is public money, a public institution, and what they're doing is they are using the internet to manipulate those who are watching. So you're thinking that one thing is going on, actually something very different is happening. And these people are really shaping the way we see the world.
Well, the thing is that right now, the public opinion is on internet. It's not on the news, it's not on the press, it's on internet. So it was time that they actually use internet on their benefit. It doesn't really surprise me, and I don't think nothing will actually happen, and certainly not from the government. They won't change it because it's beneficial for them. They are changing the public opinion to, as you say, like changing the results of a poll or the number of the views of a YouTube video. That has a massive impact in society.
Well, it can do, can't it? Especially if it's a film which nobody's actually watched. And if you look at it online, it looks as if it's had hundreds of thousands of people and everyone thinks this is going viral. Actually, no one's bothered about it at all.
Yeah, but not just like a film. I'm just thinking about someone's speech, like that they, for any reason, want it to be viral. They just make it viral in the first place, because if this video has so many visits, that would be on the first page on YouTube. So that would actually make that it actually increase the real visits.
Well, one of the things that the leaked documents say is that there is no legal restriction whatsoever on any of this. So all of the people who work for the Signals Intelligence, Government Communication, NSA, GCHQ in this case, they're just told, do what you want. there's no legal restriction on anything.
That's the problem right now, because of all these social media platforms, all this internet, this is all so new that there is no laws, there's nothing to stand for. So, for example, if you want to sue Facebook for privacy issues, everything will have to build up from nothing, because there's nothing previously of Facebook. There's nothing like Facebook. There's nothing like YouTube. It's all new.
Yeah, well, it's fascinating. Anyway, Elia, I wonder if you think that anything is going to happen to restrict the use of these big internet companies, or the power of these big internet companies and GCHQ and the NSA. We've had so many revelations of all the awful things they're up to, even things like grabbing your laptop before it gets to you to put spyware on it, you know, no matter who you are, with no reasonable excuse. Anybody can. Is there going to be any restrictions, do you think? Do you think the legislation, the law, is ever going to catch up with the technology?
I have the faith on people, so I hope at some point, like, people are already angry. People are actually looking for more information, not just on the real, like, on the main ways to get informed, like, for example, the BBC, but through internet, so they can get to real stuff, and they are getting angry. And I want to expect of some sort of revolution, internet revolution, that will make the law wake up and start doing something.
Well, maybe. I mean, I noticed also this week there was a news story that the BBC management have been spying on their own employees. 100, roughly, or just under 100 BBC journalists and staff had been being spied on by their own management, who were reading all their emails because they thought that they might be giving information out. Now, isn't that what the BBC is supposed to do? I thought that was what they were supposed to do.
It's not.
It's part
not.
Of their job. No?
It's not, but that's what they are doing now. Like, it seems like because there's no law, there's nothing illegal, everyone has the right to go through illegal, well, not illegal, but like bad ways to just get information that in another way they wouldn't be able to get.
Yeah, maybe the BBC. I mean, I wonder if it's people who are giving out information to the public that the BBC managers don't want them to.
Yeah.
That they're keeping an eye on. The other thing, of course, to remember is the BBC is much more open than many other commercial media. The mainstream media, like Murdoch, for example, is very, very, it's a business. It's extremely tight. They won't give any information out. And they have a whole department at News Corporation, I think it's called News Inc. now, I'm not sure, they've changed their name, they're always changing their name when they do something wrong, but Murdoch's News Corporation has a whole department spying on Murdoch's own journalists. But that didn't come out, the BBC thing came out. I mean, we know about that through the Leveson inquiry, but this is a news story about the BBC spying on their own people, mainly because they're going through the Parliament, and they're doing an oversight of the BBC licence fee. So that's the only reason that's come out. Anyway, so Elia, finally, are we going to see some changes in the way that the relationship between the Google, people like that, are they going to actually start really serving the public or not? Do you think they will start to realise that people don't want to be used as just a marketing tool?
I don't think so, because people don't have the money. The big companies have. But I do think things in internet will change, but it's because internet is constantly changing. 10 years ago, Facebook didn't exist. Google wasn't as powerful as it is now. So 10 years, in 10 years' time, probably Facebook won't exist, and we have another giant as Google, another one that is not going to be Google.
Well, either that, or they'll be controlling everything.
Yeah, probably they will change their name, and instead of Google will be another thing.
Okay, Elia, thanks very much for joining us again.
Thank you.
Listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
And I'm joined by Jason Yannakopoulos now. Instead of a normal news review this week, we're going to have a look at the Israel-Palestine conflict. Jason, what are your thoughts originally? Because I always think that the British have got a bit of a responsibility here. We created the State of Israel back in 1947. The Americans recognised it before we'd even probably created it, actually. The US were the first to recognise the Israeli state. It was born out of a terror campaign waged by the Irgun, who were the Jewish terrorists at the time. But what are your thoughts about whether the Brits really, you know, have got a big responsibility for what's happened in the Holy Land these days?
Well, yes, I suppose we do have a lot of responsibility with the creation of the State of Israel. that has led to conflict for a while, and I think we have a responsibility to bring peace to the region.
What's your analysis of the rights and wrongs of it all?
Well, it's very complicated on that front because, of course, depending on how, because both sides claim that claim the region is theirs and that it's ancestrally theirs. I suppose if you go back far enough to the biblical era, then I suppose yes, it was a Jewish homeland at the time. There are many Jewish states there, but of course Islam didn't exist at that point.
Well, yeah, it's all about land, it seems to me. People pointing at the land and saying that land is mine, and then someone else saying there isn't. And there's this whole thing of the right to return.
Yes.
And I think there's something really fundamentally wrong about that, because what about the right for return of the people who you've just kicked out? That is the Palestinians, for example.
Well, yes, that's the whole point. I mean, that's the whole point of this conflict. Israel was originally just a very small region. It's just expanded almost exponentially, really.
And it probably wouldn't exist without the financial help from the United States.
No, it wouldn't. It totally wouldn't. But,
and military.
Yeah. I mean, it was, I suppose you could argue, it's in the US banking corporation sort of being in their interest to create a Jewish home state of some variety. I mean,
there was quite an obvious need for it at the end of the Second World War.
Yeah.
But then there are all sorts of questions about just how Jewish the people are who are there. I mean, you know, to me, Jewish means somebody who's from the Middle East, which means you're kind of dark-skinned, you're a Semitic race, which was from that part of the world, whereas most of the Jewish people that you see are actually white-skinned Eastern Europeans. They weren't actually originally from that part. So are these people who converted to Judaism over the centuries or what?
Probably not, because a Jewish argument would state that it was a Jewish homeland for many reasons. They were forced out by... They were taken over by the Romans and the British, and probably forced out by the Ottoman Empire, or certainly some form of Asian. But yeah, I think it was the Ottoman Empire.
Well, the other argument, of course, is that a lot of Orthodox Jews, I mean, if you go to speak to them, many of them will tell you, well, this is completely unbiblical and they do not support the Zionist state in Israel. I mean, if they talk about it in those terms, in fact, they will turn up at Palestinian protests right across the world. You'll find Orthodox Jews there. Very strange situation. I wonder if you're dealing with, we're not dealing with a kind of fundamentalism here of a religious belief trumping everything. They say, well, basically, I'm sorry, you've got to get out of the way, I've got to live here because God told me I can.
Well, is it a religious belief trumping another religious belief? Is this the Holy War?
Oh dear, yes. Well, a lot of the focus, of course, is on the Temple Mount, which is the place where the old Jewish temple was in Jerusalem. This seems to be a big focus for a lot of the conflict, because what's on top of it? Well, because you've got the Dome of the Rock there, which is a very important Muslim place right in the middle of a Jewish site. So I think, you know, always a good idea to keep your eye on what's happening there. This is the original Temple of Solomon. And yet the Muslims have got a big mosque on top of it. So there's always constant conflict around that. Anyway, any thoughts about solutions before we actually go to the protest? Because there's been some protests recently and hear some people at the protest.
Solutions is very difficult without displacing a large number of people again. I would like to hope there's a two-state solution. The only problem is where you draw the boundaries on that.
Well, the boundaries seem to keep changing, don't they?
Yeah.
It started out with the sort of pepper effect, little bits of Israel, little bits of Palestine, and then slowly but surely the bits of Israel grown and grown. But anyway, so let's go now to have a listen to some live coverage from a few weeks ago at the protests that are happening here in Bristol over the Palestine and Israel conflict. And I think they were happening outside the BBC for reasons which should be obvious. A lot of people seem to believe that the BBC isn't really fairly covering the protests from one side, particularly being slightly, they say anyway, biased towards the Israeli point of view.
This is BCFM, your local radio station, and we're here today at the BBC with a friend of us. Tell us, what's your name?
My name is Lupa.
Lupa, where are you from?
Okay, originally I'm from Bangladesh, but I've
literally been brought up in Bristol, so I'm from Easton, so I'm quite local. Lupa, tell us, what are you doing today here at the Broadcasting House?
Well, we are here to raise awareness about what's going on in Palestine by the Israeli military force. They are illegal settlers, and you'll be surprised, a lot of people don't know why there are bombings going on, why there's conflict, and we're here to sort of raise awareness. And the fact that BBC, they're silent, they're only silent, but they're only telling you one-sided story, which is towards Israel. They'll never tell you what's going on in Gaza or West Bank or Ramallah, and we're here to raise awareness because we know the mainstream media does not portray the truth. So this is what we're doing, this is our job, we're here to raise awareness.
Do you think we should be ashamed of the BBC?
Most definitely, I think we should be ashamed, because at the end of the day, they're not telling you the truth. They want you to be like a sheep, believe what they want to show you, not what the truth is. So this is our job, is to raise awareness. So
yes, I think if you want to be informed, you can watch other channels like Russian TV or Al Jazeera, and you'll definitely get a different picture, completely different to the BBC.
Definitely, most definitely. If you watch Russia Today, they will definitely tell you the different side of it, whereas BBC, they will never tell you the truth. This is why we're here.
And how about the British government? What do you think?
British government? Shame on them. Shame on the West for not doing enough. Shame on the US for sticking up for Israel. Shame on them all.
Where would you like to see Palestine?
Palestine to be free, to be able to have access to simple things that we get access to. Medical, water, the basic stuff that they're actually finding it hard to get access of because it's been held. The aid that we send, unfortunately, doesn't always get to them because the Israelis always keep it back. They won't give it to them. This is like, if you want me to be honest, this is like what Hitler did to the Jews. It's disgusting. They're being massacred and we're not doing anything. We've turned a blind eye, and shame on us for turning a blind eye. But we want to raise awareness, and by the will of God, we will change. We'll make change.
You think it doesn't matter really where you're from or what religion you're from?
No, definitely. A lot of people think it's to do with Muslims and Muslims are sticking up for Gaza. No, you don't need to be a Muslim to feel what the Palestinians feel. You just need to be human. Basic human feelings. We don't like seeing bloodshed. Nobody does. Forget your colour. Forget what religion you follow or what faith you have. Nothing to do with that. It's all basic human feelings that you have. Why should we have bloodshed? What for? You know?
How can you help Palestine? Like, for example, in the everyday life of a consumer? Boycotting maybe certain supermarkets?
I'm a bit into I'm in two minds about boycotting because I'm not 100% sure whether us boycotting will make a change, but there have been reports that has made change. For example, you know that soda?
Soda Stream.
They've lost a lot of profit due to boycott. I also believe that if we help with aid, gift aid, with any trusted charity, this is how we can help. And not forgetting, we need to raise awareness, because I've been surprised in the past few years that I've been involved in raising awareness of Palestine. Not a lot of people know what is actually going on. They've misunderstood what is happening. They've misunderstood, like, who's broken the ceasefire. We all know deep inside that Israel's broken the ceasefire, and we need to raise awareness of it. To allow people to realise that this is happening, and the mainstream media will not let you see what is actually going on.
Well, thanks very much, Lupa, for talking to us. BCFM, the best for Palestine. Peace on Palestine.
Peace for Palestine. Pray for Palestine. Pray for everyone that's suffering around the world. That's all I ask.
Thanks very much, Lupa, for talking to us. Thank you.
And that was Rosabelle, who's from BCFM's Latin Window programme, who's down at the protests outside the BBC. So it does seem a bit of a one-sided conflict. The Israelis are armed to the teeth. They've got something like at least 50 nuclear weapons. They are a nuclear-armed state. And the Palestinians, Hamas, seem to be firing back with these rockets, which aren't all that well. They're not guided in any way. They're a bit ineffective. But why is it so one-sided, Jason? What are your thoughts?
Well, the reason it's so one-sided is because the Israeli state was set up by the British and Americans, and so the British and Americans see they have a vested interest in the continuation of the Israeli state. So they train the Israeli military, they provide weaponry, they provide everything the army needs there.
Yeah, it's a bit one-sided anyway. Yeah, so nice to hear the prayers for peace, because that's a really important side of things. Anyway, looking at the deeper stuff really here, we're going to have a little listen to Webster Tarpley in a minute and his take on the Venetians and the Rosicrucians, because a lot of this stuff has been going for a long time, and certainly I am absolutely convinced that there is a whole quite secretive profession behind the scenes, a really tiny number of people that
just
that,
the one
well a tiny number of people that try to get wars going, actually, because it's good for business. What are your thoughts about that, Jason? Is that, am I just being a crazy conspiracy theorist?
No, Britain and America, I believe, well, NATO in general, like to intervene in wars because, of course, they are the chief beneficiaries of the arms trade. And what better way to stoke the fires in the arms trade? What's better way to keep it going than to be involved in wars?
Well, I also heard, I was chatting with one of the senior politicians in the city the other day, Mark Weston, who's the leader now of the Conservative group on Bristol City Council, and he was absolutely adamant. He said there's only one thing to say about what was going on in Israel-Palestine, is Netanyahu doesn't want peace.
Yeah, that I think that's a fair statement.
I mean, it seems that it was about to be a peace deal signed, and then all of a sudden this thing happened, didn't it, with the kidnapping and everything. And I just wonder, I mean, it's awful, but you think that, you know, that this sort of incident with the kidnapping of the three Jewish boys has actually been, you know, rather than being dealt with and negotiated around, as being milked, because there's no actual evidence that Hamas, at all, that Hamas were behind that kidnapping.
Yes, that did seem an odd one. I mean, that suddenly we get this story and they immediately blame it on Hamas. Hamas has not claimed credit for the kidnapping.
Well, you would say they probably wouldn't, because it was an awful thing to do and embarrassing, wouldn't it?
Well, it was certainly reprehensible, whoever did carry it out.
The other thing is that whoever did carry out the kidnapping was speaking in Hebrew. That was recorded by the police, the Israeli police, and a phone call that was made, an emergency phone call that was made by one of the lads as he was being kidnapped, was broadcast by the Israeli police, and it was clearly heard one of the kidnappers using Hebrew to tell him to get into the car. But then, of course, you know, that doesn't necessarily have to be a Jewish person. It could easily be a Palestinian who's learnt to speak Hebrew in order to do such a nasty kidnapping job. But anyway, okay, so let's have a listen now to Webster Tarpley. He's United States, he's the author of two really important books I've had a look at anyway. One's called George Herbert Walker Bush, The Unauthorized Biography, and the other one's 9/11 Synthetic Terror Made in USA. And Webster Tarpley here talks about the Venetians, the Rosicrucians, and the Machiavellians behind our modern wars.
This is Webster Tarpley here in Edinburgh. I've been studying the Venetians really since about the 1950s, and I actually wrote my dissertation at Princeton, my senior essay in Princeton, about the Italian background of Milton, which leads you right into this Sarpi network. So I've been studying this for quite a few years and given lectures about it. So the basic idea is the following. The characteristic methods of the Roman Empire and the Byzantine Empire did not end when the Roman Empire in the West became extinct in 476 or so AD, nor did they end in the 1450s when Constantinople was captured by the Turks, by the Ottoman Empire. But rather, there had been a transfer of a significant part of the Byzantine culture and method in terms of imperialist method, geopolitics, and especially the principle they have that religion serves the state. As you remember, in Byzantium, of course, they have this Caesaropapism, and the emperor is a god, and the religion is a department of the government, because the patriarch is always appointed. He's very much under the thumb of the emperor. Now, here in Western Europe, it's always been very different, because here we have the emperor and the pope, or the king and the pope, are different people, and they fight. And this is what has opened up in the Western mind the notion of separation of powers and a kind of an anti-totalitarian bias, because you're not dealing with one power center, you're dealing with two. And that makes all the difference in the world in terms of being able to think for yourself because you're called upon to choose. And it is no coincidence, of course, that the origins of modern Europe are in these Italian city-states of northern Italy, precisely in the area where the influence of both the Pope and the Holy Roman Emperor, where this crosses, and therefore you have a choice, right? You can be a Guelph and go with the Pope, you can be a Ghibelline and go with the Emperor. Now the Venetians are a branch, they claim, of the Byzantine Empire. And they claim that they go back to the time when Attila the Hun was on his way to Rome, that the refugees fled into the lagoon. So they would tell you that the foundation of Venice is in the 400 AD range, and that's probably too soon. But they do go back a long way, right? And of course, in oligarchy, the antiquity of your family means a great deal. And by that standard, the Royal House of England are complete upstarts compared to any respectable Venetian family who go back 700, 900, 1,000 years. And of course, the normal nobility of England and France don't come anywhere close to that. So it is a conduit for the mentality of the Byzantine Empire to come into the modern world. Now, of course, it is the main medieval banking center. The banking centers of the Middle Ages are basically two. One is Venice, one is Genoa. And they are rivals, but there's much that they have in common, although the Genoese never quite get that Byzantine method. And of course, what it means is that in Genoa, the place is torn up by faction fights. But what the Venetians have been able to do is to create institutions that allow them to have an oligarchy, but at the same time to have what amounts to a totalitarian and in some ways communistic order under the control of an extremely narrow patrician class of maybe 2,000 people in a society that varies from maybe 500,000 to 4 or 5 million at different times. If we look at their influence, right, by having money lending networks and trade networks, although very seldom manufacturing, that's the big thing with the Venetians. The Florentines under the Medici produce textiles. The Venetians produce very little, a little bit of glass, a little bit of lace, but mainly it's banking, insurance, financial services, and simply trade, which means taking other people's production and turning that into money on a different market. If we look at, let's say, the Plantagenet dynasty here, the Plantagenets in England are very largely puppets of Venice. The best example is Edward III, and Edward III starts this lunatic adventure of the Hundred Years' War, which really is the destruction of medieval civilization is very largely mediated with the Hundred Years' War between 1350 and about 1450, because these are the two most advanced parts of Western Europe. And it is the Venetians who invite and encourage Edward III to do that, because the Venetians are always afraid that the French are going to come and crush them. And the Hundred Years' War coincides pretty much with the final struggle between Venice and Genoa. And the French, of course, might have taken that opportunity to conquer both of them. So they make sure that France is completely tied up with this Hundred Years' struggle with the English. William of Ockham, that some people value, I don't, one of the stupidest nominalists of the late Middle Ages, is in his political form, is also completely to be condemned, because he's actually working in Bavaria, King Ludwig of Bavaria. He's trying to essentially, what Ockham is doing is to try to get Ludwig of Bavaria to open a second front against the French, to weaken them even more vis-a-vis the English, and again to make sure the main issue is that the French are not going to give any trouble to the Venetians. Generally speaking, over the years, you'll find that the Venetians have hostile relations to their immediate neighbors. And then beyond that, you might find a belt of states where they have better relations. And the example, of course, is England. The Venetians, I just delved into this a little bit, and I hope to be able to write this up for the 500th anniversary of Luther now in 2017, if I lived that long. The Venetian method extends into doing things like this. You have the War of the League of Cambrai in 1509, almost completely forgotten. It is a world war. It is the Great World War at the beginning of the modern era. And at the beginning of it, it's a very one-sided combination. It is essentially France, Spain, the Holy Roman Emperor, the Pope, most of the smaller Italian states, and a few others, all against the Venetians. So it's Europe against Venice. And there's a very interesting painting, the Allegory of the League of Cambrai, which by Palma Giovane, which is displayed in the room of the Venetian Senate. If you're going to go from the Venetian Senate to the room of the Doge and his advisors, you've got to go under this painting of a woman on a bull attacking Venice, meaning Venice is anti-European in the deepest sense. They're Byzantine, and they also seek the ruin of all the European powers, and they do succeed in getting out of that fix. But one of the ways they do it is the Venetians are very, very much afraid now, not only of the French, who defeat them in a big battle, which is a catastrophe for them, the Battle of Agnadello in 1509, but the Venetians are also concerned about a huge army coming down from Germany, and at one point, an army of about 100,000 people, if you count the camp followers, one of the biggest armies ever seen in Europe, comes down and besieges the Venetians pretty much in their lagoons. So they respond to that in a characteristic way, which is to try to create a diversion in Germany so that people will be fighting and killing each other in Germany, far away from Venice, north of the Alps, and they won't be troubled by any more invasions. And what they therefore do is mobilize their networks, and they find that the humanist of central Germany, Mucianus Rufus, has a pupil. Mucianus is somebody who has been in contact with Venetian oligarchs, as he writes in his letters. And Mucianus says he's got a protege by the name of Spalatin, another German humanist, who is actually the at this time, he's rising through the bureaucracy of King Frederick, Elector Frederick the Wise of Saxony, the ruler of Saxony, up in northern Germany, the area around Leipzig and Wittenberg and places like this. And out of this combination of Mucianus and Spalatin, they find Luther. Luther fits their needs to a T, because he's an extremely crude German nationalist, which is a great cover. He's, how can I say it? In terms of theology, he's about as primitive as possibly can be. And he also, interestingly enough, claims that salvation is by faith alone and not by any works. In other words, you're not supposed to, the works of charity are devalued in this. And it just happens to turn out that one of the greatest experts of the Venetian intelligence service, one of the greatest game masters of the last 1,000 years, is a fellow called Gasparo Contarini, who was actually a cardinal of the Roman Catholic Church at this point. Or he will be, sorry, at this point he's not, but he will be. And Contarini, in the middle of this crisis of the Venetian state, has had a religious crisis of his own, where he comes about one micron away from endorsing the notion of faith alone, salvation by faith alone, that we humans are poor worms and we're not really capable of love, and therefore the only thing we can do is hope that God will help us. And he does this in a way that indicates that it's a doctrinal break. So in about, 1513, we have Contarini having this experience. And then a few years later, we have Luther having exactly the same kind of experience. Just one step further, he says, it's faith alone, no works at all. Only grace, only faith, and only by the scriptures. And that basically, that comes out of the War of the League of Cambrai. In other words, most people don't realize that the Luther Reformation comes in a time of war, and indeed of a general European war, which has got Henry VIII in it. In other words, this is when Henry VIII invades northern France, and the French at a certain point are in really bad shape. It's the time of Wolsey and Henry VIII, and they go with Venice most of the time. Not completely, but most of the time. So I think that's an interesting example of the Venetian method. The other one that I think is extremely important is Paolo Sarpi. But it even goes back further. For example, let's take Henry VIII. when Henry VIII has his great fight with the Pope, there's this question about, can he marry Anne Boleyn? Can he divorce Catherine of Aragon and marry Anne Boleyn? So what Henry VIII does is he writes letters to all the universities of Europe, and he asks them, you know, am I right to do this? Is this, you know, can I put away Catherine of Aragon and marry Anne Boleyn? And he gets back a lot of responses, but the most positive one he gets is from the Venetians in Padua. And there's this character, he's a really kooky, a rationalist writer by the name of Francesco Giorgi, or Zorzi. He was a Venetian oligarch. He's a friend of Contarini, that we've just mentioned, the guy who basically dishes up Luther for you. And Zorzi comes to the English court, and he delivers the opinion. Henry is delighted with him. And Zorzi then stays at the English court pretty much for the rest of his life as what amounts to Henry VIII's resident sex advisor. So there's an intrigue, and most of the books that you read about Henry VIII don't have this fact. Anyway, Sarpi comes, what, 75 years later, and Sarpi is concerned with the fact that the Venetians are getting weaker and weaker, and he's got to promote another general war, which is going to become the 30 Years' War. So this is the era of the gunpowder plot of 1605, the Spanish conspiracy against Venice alleged in 1618, and then the defenestration of Prague, right? The beginning of the 30 Years' War, also in May of 1618. And what you see here is that Sarpi is the ego ideal of many people in England. In other words, there's an English cult of Sarpi, which would include such people as John Donne, Sir Francis Bacon, Thomas Hobbes, John Milton, other people maybe less known, Sir Dudley Carleton, Foreign Secretary, Sir Henry Wotton, almost became Foreign Secretary, the guy who brought the Palladio architecture to England, and otherwise was the Provost of Eton, various other churchmen, the Herbert family, Herbert of Cherbury. Also, these are also ancestors of Bush, by the way, the Herbert. Sarpi. There's a whole book about Sarpi's Englishmen, right? Paolo Sarpi and his English friends. Sarpi, of course, is the most famous person in Europe who's not a king or a prince. And he's involved in the interdict, the so-called struggle between Venice and the papacy in 1606 and 1607, which he wins. He attracts the imagination of all of Protestant Europe by being a Catholic friar who opposes the Pope on a matter of jurisdiction. Does the Vatican have the right to say certain churchmen who are criminals have to be delivered to the church, or can they be punished in the normal courts? And the Pope, of course, says that all belongs to me. So later on, you have people like Gibbon, the decline and fall of the Roman Empire, is a great admirer of Sarpi. Trevor Roper loves Sarpi, the professor of history at Oxford, Lord Dacre until quite recently. And, well, we can just go through the list. In other words, Dr. Johnson, they all love this Sarpi.
But what's the Sarpi method?
Well, the Sarpi method, of course, is to create religious warfare. In other words, you have to do a divide and conquer, right? The Venetians believe that religion serves state interest. And therefore, what you have a network around Sarpi, and Sarpi's friends, not just these English ones, but they help, and the other ones that he has a group in Holland, a group in Poland, a group in France, a group in, you name it, he's got it. He's got a group in North America, which is a little bit weaker. But what they do is they're essentially involved in making peaceful coexistence. I'll give you one example. In Holland, there are two parties. In the Netherlands, there's the Oldenbarneveld party, and this is the great hero of the Dutch. He created the country, like George Washington. And then there's this other guy who's Prince Maurice of Nassau. So Oldenbarneveld says, tolerance towards Protestant minorities inside, peace with Spain, and peaceful economic development based on, you know, manufacturing. The Maurice of Nassau says, no tolerance, extreme Calvinism, war with Spain, and loot the Spanish and Portuguese empires with the Dutch fleet. So Sarpi is supposed to be, most academics will tell you Sarpi is a great friend of tolerance and moderation. Of course, he comes in on the side of the extremist Maurice of Nassau. And Dudley Carleton, Sarpi's right-hand man at this point, the Englishman, he intervenes to make sure that Alden Barneveld has his head chopped off. It's amazing. It's George Washington, and his own country kills him. So this is what the Venetians do, and you can see how they're doing this in all these other countries. One of the things going on is the assassination of Henry IV of France, King Henry IV, Le Bon Henri. And everybody has always said the Catholics did this, but it's not at all certain that the Catholics did it, and it may indeed have been a false flag. It's a Catholic friar who does it, but who sent him there? So the point of this is, what we get to, is that the Whig party in England is the Venetian party. The great aristocrats, right, the court party, the top nobility, people who vibe with the king, these are the Venetian party. And I've tried to call attention to this novel by Benjamin Disraeli called Coningsby, 1844, where you get this. He actually comes out and says it in very blunt terms, and I welcome that, because that is a confirmation of research that I had done over decades before I ever heard of Coningsby or ever knew about Disraeli as a novelist in this kind of a context. There's a guy called Sir Edwin Sandys, known as the first Whig, and he is a Sarpi collaborates in writing this guy's book and in getting it published. And basically, Sandys and Sarpi are co-authors of a book, and that's the guy who's the first Whig. So if you want to know how did London become this imperial center and banking center, and how did the Foreign Office ever get their method of divide and conquer, you have to look at the Venetians. Walsingham founded the Secret Intelligence Service. And he was trained in Venice. He was a Bloody Mary exile.
Had to get now MI6.
Well, secret in SIS, secret in MI6. So Walsingham had to go to Padua during the time of Bloody Mary. And in that time, it's clear he's recruited, he's trained. And he brings back the Venetian method of creating religious conflict. And this is what you see then. This is the background of the gunpowder plot, is that. Because that's how Cecil gets it. Cecil, Lord Burghley, Cecil the Elder, Robert Cecil the Younger, and these are contemporaries and enemies of Shakespeare. So Shakespeare is somebody who's anti-Venetian. He's actually pro-Catholic. And it basically, the whole idea of who the good guys are and who the bad guys are, according to these Whig historians, is bunk.
So there you have it. War has been cooked up for hundreds of years, and Shakespeare put his finger on it in many of his plays. More from Webster Tarpley completing that piece next week. And his point really is, if you don't have a solid peace program, you're going to have war. That's all for this week. Dialect is Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast and is on Bristol Community FM 93.2 at 11 a.m. every Thursday morning. If you're online, you can subscribe to our emails or download the podcast from Dialect Radio, one word, .co.uk. Thanks to our guests, Elia Pablo, Jason Yannakopoulos, and also Webster Tarpley, you just heard there, also studio engineer Dave Bazanko. Dialect's a Bristol Broadband Co-op production, and anyone can contribute. If you'd like to, do contact us through Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733 or at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. The number again, 0117 989 7733. That was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Till the same time next week. Goodbye for now.
Astrolasia, and I always feel a bit bad because the Astrolasia put lots of good records, and I never seem to get around to playing them because, frankly, they're too long. I know that's a ludicrous reason for not playing them, but it's the reason that I have to give. This is from the LP on Magic Eye Records called The Space Between.
I have come to show you.
Oh, yeah? He's going to speak again, isn't he?
I have come to show you.
This is Afterlife. Well, I've just spoken rather inadvertently to them on the phone and they're all ready to go there in foreign parts. Yeah. On Magic Eye Records from the LP The Space Between, this is Astralasia and Afterlife. Don't forget, tomorrow night between 8 and 10 on Radio 1, it's Guided by Voices in session on the programme. And now, as we've been threatening to do all afternoon, we go live to Ibiza. Here's Danny Rampling.